Bright Lance 2, this is Leader, do you read me? Leader, this is 2, Joe's voice answered him immediately. I have you visual. In the name of God, get out of there. What's my position? We're 50 miles within Syrian territory. Our course for base is 250 degrees. How did you go? I took out one of mine. The other one ran for it. After that, I was too busy keeping an eye on you. David blinked his eyes and was surprised to find that sweat was pouring down his forehead from under his helmet, and his mask was slick and sticky with blood from his nosebleed. His arms and shoulders still ached, and he felt drunken and light-headed from the effects of gravity and combat, and his hands on the control column were shaky and weak. I got 2, he said. 2 of the swines. 1 for Deborah and 1 for Hannah. Shut up, Davy. Joe's voice was stiff with tension. Concentrate on getting out of here. You are within range of both flak and ground missiles. Light your tail and let's go. Negative, David answered him. I'm low on fuel. Where are you? 6 o'clock high at 25,000. As he answered, Joe sat up in his seat, leaning forward against his shoulder straps, to watch the tiny wedge shape of David's machine far below. It was climbing slowly up to meet him. Slowly, too slowly, and low, too low. David was vulnerable, and Joe was afraid for him, frowning heavily into his face mask and searching restlessly, sweeping heaven and earth for the first hint of danger. 2 minutes would see them clear, but they would be 2 long, slow minutes. He almost missed the first missile. The ground crew must have allowed David to overfly their launch pad before they put it up in pursuit, for Joe picked up its vapor trail as it streaked in from behind David, closing rapidly with him. Missile, break left, Joe yelled into his mask. Go, go, go! And he saw David begin his turn instantly, steeply, sidestepping the sizzling attack of the missile. It's lost you, Joe called, as the missile continued its crazy career through space, beginning to yaw from side to side as it hunted for a target and at last bursting in self-destruction. Keep going, Davy, Joe encouraged him, but keep awake, there'll be more. They both saw the next one leave the ground from its camouflaged vehicle. There was a nest of them on a rocky ridge above a sun-blasted plain. A serpent slid off the rock and lifted into the sky, climbing rapidly towards David's little machine. Light your tail, Joe told him, and wait for it. He watched the missile boring in, converging with dazzling speed on David's mirage. Break right! Go, go, go! Joe yelled, and David twisted violently aside. Again the serpent slid past him, overshooting, but this time not losing contact and coming around to attack again, its seekers locked to David's machine. He's still on you, Joe was screaming now. Go for the sun, Davy, try for the sun! And the mirage pointed its nose at the great blazing orb that burned above the mountain ranges of dark cloud. The serpent followed him upwards, hunting him with the dreadful single-mindedness of the automaton. He's onto you, Davy. Flip out now. Go, go, go! David flicked the mirage out of her vertical climb and fell like a stone, while the serpent fastened its attention upon the vast infrared output from the sun and streaked on towards it, losing the mirage. You've lost it. Get out, Davy. Get out, Joe pleaded with him. But for the moment, the mirage was helpless. In her desperate climb for the sun, she had lost maneuvering speed and was wallowing clumsily now. It would be many seconds before she became agile and lithe once again, and by then it would be too late, for Joe saw the third missile becoming airborne and dart upwards on its feather of flame and smoke, aiming at David's mirage. Joe did not consciously realize what he was going to do until he had winged over and commenced his dive under full power. He came down with his Mach meter indicating twice the speed of sound, and he leveled across David's tail, cutting obliquely across his track under the nose of the oncoming serpent. The serpent saw him with its little cyclops radar eye, and it sensed the heat of his exhausts, fresher, more tantalizing than David's, and it accepted him as an alternative target and swung away after him, leaving David to fly on unscathed. David saw Joe's aircraft flash past his wingtip at searing speed, and but an instant behind him followed the serpent. It took him only a second to realize that Joe had deliberately pulled the missile off him, had accepted the attack that must surely have destroyed David. He watched with fascinated horror as Joe pulled out of his dive and used his speed to climb into the sun. The missile followed him smoothly angling upwards, overhauling Joe's mirage with effortless ease. Joe was watching the missile in his mirror, and at the last instant he flipped out of the climb, but this time the serpent was not deceived. As Joe dropped, so it swiveled also, and as earlier David had wallowed helplessly, now Joe was in the same predicament. He had taken his chance, and it had not worked for him. The missile found him, and in a brusque burst of flame, Joe and his mirage died together. David flew on alone, his mirage once more at maneuvering speed, and his throat dry with horror and fear and grief. He found himself talking aloud. Joe, no. Joe, oh God, no, you shouldn't have done it. Ahead of him, through the gaps in the mass of cloud bases, he saw the Jordan. It should be you that's going home, Joe, he said. It should be you, Joe, and felt the hard ball of sorrow in his throat. But the instinct of survival was still strong, and David yawed and glanced back to clear his blind spot. And he saw the last missile coming in on him. It was just a small black speck far behind, with a little frill of dark smoke around it. But it was watching him hungrily with its wicked little eye. As he saw it, he knew beyond doubt that this one was his, the one that the fates had reserved for him. The attacks he had evaded so far had worn his nerves and strained his judgment. He felt a sense of fatalistic dismay as he watched the attacking missile gaining on him. Nevertheless, he gathered his scattered reserves for one more supreme effort. His eyes narrowed to slits, the sweat sliding down his face and drenching his mask, his left hand holding the throttle fully open and his right gripping the control column with the strength of despair, he judged his moment. The missile was almost upon him, and he screamed with all his might and hurled the mirage into the turn, but he had misjudged it by the smallest part of a second. As he turned away, the missile slid past him, and it was close enough to pick up the shadow of the mirage in the photoelectric eye of its fusing device. The eye winked at him, and the missile exploded. The mirage was in the critical attitude of its turn, and the cockpit canopy was exposed entirely to the center of the blast. It hit the plane with a blow that sent it tumbling. Like a running man tripping, it went over, and it lost lift and flying capability. The canopy was penetrated by flying steel. A piece struck David's armored seat with a clang, and then it glanced off and struck his left arm above the elbow, snapping the bone cleanly so that the arm dropped uselessly and hung into his lap. An icy wind raged through the torn canopy as the mirage hurled itself through space with suicidal force, whipping its nose through the vicious motions and flat plane of high-speed spin. David was thrown against his straps, his ribs bruised and his skin smearing from his shoulders, and the broken arm flailing agonizingly. He tried to hold himself upright in his seat as he reached up over his head, caught hold of the handle of the ejector mechanism, and hauled the blind down over his face. He expected to have the charge explode beneath his seat and hurl him free of the doomed mirage. But nothing happened. Desperately, he released the handle and strained forward to reach the secondary firing mechanism under his seat between his feet. He wrenched it and felt despair as there was no response. The seat was not working. The blast had damaged some vital part of it. He had to fly the mirage out of it, with one arm and very little altitude left to him. He fastened his right fist onto the molded grip of the stick, and in the crazy fall and flutter and whirl, David began to fight for control, flying now by instinct alone, for he was badly hurt, and sky and horizon, earth and cloud spun giddily across his vision. He was aware that he was losing height rapidly, for every time the earth swayed through his line of vision, it was closer and more menacing. But doggedly, he continued his attempts to roll against the direction of spin. The earth was very close before he felt the first hint of response, and the ferocity of her gyrations abated slightly. Stick and rudder together, he tried again, and the mirage showed herself willing at last. Gently, with the touch of a lover, he wooed her, and suddenly she came out, and he was flying straight and level. But she was hard hit. The blast of the missile had done mortal damage, and she was heavy and sick in his hands. He could feel the rough vibration of the engine shaking her, and he guessed that the compressor had thrown a blade and was now out of balance. Within minutes or seconds, she would begin to tear herself to pieces. He could not try for climbing power on her. David looked quickly about him and realized with a shock how far he had fallen in that terrible tumble down the sky. He was only 200 or 300 feet above the earth. He was not sure of his direction, but when he glanced at his Doppler compass, he found with mild surprise that he was still heading in the general direction of home. The engine vibration increased, and he could hear the shrill screech of rending metal. He wasn't going to make it home, that was certain, and there was insufficient height to jettison the canopy, release his straps, and attempt to scramble out of the cockpit. There was only one course still remaining. He must fly the Mirage in. Even as he made the decision, his one good hand was busy implementing it. Holding the stick between his knees, he let down his landing gear. The nose wheel might hold him up long enough to take some speed off her and prevent her cartwheeling. He looked ahead and saw a low ridge of rocky ground and sparse green vegetation. Disaster lurked for him there. But beyond it were open fields, ploughed land, orderly blocks of orchards, neatly laid out buildings. That in itself was cheering. Such order and industry could only mean that he'd returned across the border to Israel. David skimmed over the ridge of broken rocks, sucking in his own belly as though to lift the Mirage bodily over the hungry teeth of granite, and ahead of him lay the fields. He could see women working in one of the orchards, stopping and turning to look at him, so close that he could clearly see the expressions of surprise and apprehension on their faces. There was a man on a blue tractor, and he jumped from his seat and fell to the earth as David passed only feet above his head. All fuel cocks closed, all switches off, master switch off. David went into the final ritual for crash landing. Ahead of him lay the smooth brown field, open and clear. He might just be lucky enough. It might just come off. The Mirage was losing flying speed, her nose coming up, the airspeed needle sinking back, 200 miles per hour, 190, 180, dropping back to her stalling speed of 150. Then suddenly, David realized that the field ahead of him was latticed with deep concrete irrigation channels. They were 20 feet wide and 10 deep, a deadly hazard, enough to destroy a Centurion tank. There was nothing David could do now to avoid their gaping jaws. He flew the Mirage in, touching down smoothly. Smooth as a tomcat pissing on a sheet of velvet, he thought bitterly, aware that all his skill was unavailing now. Even Barney would have been proud of me. The field was rough, but the Mirage settled to it, pitching and lurching, shaking David ruthlessly about the cockpit. But she was up on all three wheels, losing speed handily, her undercart taking the strain. However, she was still travelling at 90 miles an hour when she went into the irrigation ditch. It snapped her undercart off like pretzel sticks, and she nosed in, struck the far bank of concrete that sheared through metal like a scythe, and sent the fuselage cartwheeling across the field with David still strapped within it. The wings broke away, and the body slid on across the soft earth, to come to rest at last, right way up like a stranded whale. The whole of David's left side was numb, no feeling in his arm or leg. The straps had mauled him with their rude grasp, and he was stunned and bewildered in the sudden engrossing silence. For many seconds he sat still, unable to move or think. Then he smelled it, the pervasive reek of Avtar jet fuel from the ruptured tanks and lines. The smell of it galvanized him with the pilot's deadly fear of fire. With his right hand he grabbed the canopy release lever and heaved at it. He wasted 10 precious seconds with it, for it was jammed solid. Then he turned his attention to the steel canopy breaker in its niche below the lever. This was a tool specially designed for this type of emergency. He lifted it, lay back in his seat, and attacked the Perspex dome above his head. The stink of jet fuel was overpowering, filling the cockpit, and he could hear the little pinging and tinkling sound made by white-hot metal. His left arm hampered him. He had no feeling or use in it. The straps bound him tightly to his seat, and he had to pause in his assault upon the canopy to loosen them. Then he began again. He tore an opening in the Perspex the size of a hand, and as he worked to enlarge it, a ruptured fuel pressure line somewhere in the shattered fuselage sprayed a jet of Avtar high in the air. It fell in a heavy drizzle upon the canopy like a garden sprinkler, poured down the curved sides, and dribbled through the hole David was cutting. It fell into his face, icy cold on his cheeks and stinging his eyes. It drenched his shoulders and the front of his pressure suit, and David began to pray. For the first time ever in his life, the words took on meaning, and he felt his terror receding. "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one." He prayed aloud, striking up at the softly yielding perspex and feeling the soft rain of death in his face. He tore at the opening with his hands, bringing away slabs of transparent material, but ripping his gloves and leaving his blood smearing the jagged edges of the opening. Blessed be his name, whose glorious kingdom is forever. The opening was large enough. He hauled himself up in the seat and found himself caught by the oxygen and radio lines attached to his helmet. He could not reach them with his crippled left arm. He stared down at the offending limb and saw the blood welling out of the torn sleeve of the suit. There was no pain, but it was twisted at a comical angle from the elbow. "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart," he whispered, and with his right hand he tore loose the chin strap and let his helmet drop to the floorboards. The after soaked into the soft, dark mop of his hair and ran down his neck behind his ears, and he thought about the flames of hell. Painfully, he dragged himself out through the opening in the canopy. And now not even prayer could hold off the dark hordes of terror that assaulted his soul. "For the anger of God will kindle against you." Laboriously, he crawled across the slippery, sleek metal of the wing root and fell to the ground. He fell face down and lay for a moment, exhausted by fear and effort. "Remember all the commands of God,"